So Matthew chapter 2, verse 13 to the end of the chapter. Now when they had departed, behold, an angel of the Lord appeared to Joseph in a dream. So that's when the wise men had departed. And said, "Rise, take the child and his mother and flee to Egypt. And remain there until I tell you, for Herod is about to search for the child to destroy him." And he rose and took the child and his mother by night and departed to Egypt and remained there until the death of Herod. This was to fulfill what the Lord had spoken by the prophet, "Out of Egypt I called my son." Then Herod, when he saw that he had been tricked by the wise men, became furious, and he sent and killed all the male children in Bethlehem and in all that region who were 2 years old or younger, according to the time that he ascertained from the wise men. Then was fulfilled what was spoken by the prophet Jeremiah. A voice was heard in Ramah, weeping and loud lamentation, Rachel weeping for her children. She refused to be comforted because they are no more. But when Herod died, behold, an angel of the Lord appeared in a dream to Joseph in Egypt, saying, "Rise, take the child and his mother, and go to the land of Israel, for those who sought the child's life are dead." And he rose and took the child and his mother, and went to the land of Israel. But when he heard that Archelaus was reigning over Judea in place of his father Herod, he was afraid to go there. And being warned in a dream, he withdrew to the district of Galilee. And he went and lived in a city called Nazareth, that what was spoken by the prophets might be fulfilled. He shall be called a Nazarene. Well, please keep that open, and then inside your service sheets is an outline of where we're going. There are pens dotted around if you find it helpful to take notes. The more you think about it, the more surprising the whole Jesus business is. I mean, how God did things. If you're regulars, you'll be pretty used to this, but it really is surprising. It's not what you would expect. We've seen that in Jesus, God was sending the long-promised Messiah into the world, the King of Kings, the Lord of Lords. We've seen that in Jesus, the Almighty Creator God himself was coming into the world because he is Emmanuel, God with us. Now, if you or I were God, we'd have done it very differently. So we'd have had, you know, the heavens open and a global event. We'd have had world leaders gathered together as the Son of God comes down in a blaze of glory and power. We'd have a sort of 100-meter tall figure, shining bright, striding across the earth, everyone falling to the ground in awe. That's what you would expect. That would be the sort of the Marvel film version. But it was nothing like that. Instead, he slipped into the world quietly, unnoticed, hidden away for months in the womb of a teenage mum in a little country in the Middle East. And then he was born as a weak, helpless baby and laid in an animal feeding trough. It's very, very odd how God did things. It's not what you would expect. It's so small, obscure, hidden away, ordinary. The other week we were wondering, what resources should we buy in for the barge for Advent? And we ordered a come and see Advent devotional box for £21.99. Just as a sample thing. And, you know, when it came, we opened the box, great anticipation. And all that was in there was a booklet and a candle and a glue stick and some marshmallows. And it was not what we were expecting. And so we sent it back. And when we come and see Jesus in these first chapters of Matthew's Gospel, we may feel a sort of similar sense of anticlimax, disappointment even, and maybe doubt. You know, it is not what you would expect. And in the Bible passage I've just read, so Matthew 2:13-23, this pattern continues in Jesus' childhood as well. There are these three scenes in three locations. And these snapshots from the early life of the Messiah are not what you would expect to find in the family album of the King of Kings. Prince William, I mean, he grew up, didn't he, in Kensington Palace, Highgrove House. He went to Eton. That's what you would expect, wouldn't you, for a future king. But Jesus, fleeing to Egypt, narrowly escaping being killed in Bethlehem, then returning to live up in obscure Nazareth. It seems so unimpressive, so unfitting. Is this really the Messiah? Is this God with us? And the answer is, it is. It really is. This is God at work. So in each of these three scenes, we're told that each event was according to plan. It was fulfilling what God had said through the prophets. So if you've got it open on page 974, you'll see that in verse 15, verse 17, verse 23, fulfilling what the prophets had said. So this was God at work. And did you spot that also on three occasions, an angel of the Lord appears in a dream to Joseph. Joseph was Jesus' legal father, telling him what to do next. We get that in verse 13 and verse 19 and verse 22. So this was God at work, fulfilling past scriptures, directing present events, assuring us that Jesus really is the Christ, that we become his disciples and we continue as his disciples. And the way that God was at work back then is how God works today. So God has not changed his MO, if we can put it that way. And it's really, really important we see this, or we will miss what God is up to today, as well as what he was up to back then. So God delights to work through what is small and ordinary and obscure and hidden and despised. So three short true stories, three locations. Firstly, the flight to Egypt. That heading there that the translators have put in our Bible, it risks giving the wrong impression. Flight to Egypt. Sounds like a sort of fun family getaway. You know, commercial flight from Bethlehem International Airport, landing in Sharm el-Sheikh, on the Red Sea, top-notch resort, white sand beaches, crystal clear waters, world-class diving. We think very, very nice indeed. This was a different type of flight. This was fleeing for your life type of flight. This was flight in the sense of asylum seekers fleeing their home country. Small boats crossing the channel. Refugees huddling in camps. This was Jesus the displaced. Look at what happens. So verse 13, an angel of the Lord tells Joseph in a dream, take the child and his mother and flee to Egypt. Because Herod was about to try to kill Jesus. And so verse 14, he rose and took the child and his mother by night and departed to Egypt. So this young family, they grab whatever they can carry. They leave home in the middle of the night. And it's a 75-mile journey to the border. Now, why Egypt? Why did they go to Egypt? Well, a number of reasons. It borders Israel. It was outside Herod's jurisdiction. There were already a million Jews living there. Earlier generations of Israelites had sought refuge in Egypt. So loads of, you know, good practical reasons for fleeing to Egypt. But there was also a theological reason why God sent them to Egypt. So if you look at verse 15, it says, this was to fulfill what the Lord had spoken by the prophet. Out of Egypt I called my son. Now that is an Old Testament quotation. It's from Hosea 11 verse 1. And when you read that, you might say, well, when did this happen? When did God call his son out of Egypt? And the answer is in the Exodus. You see, Israel was God's son. So Exodus 4:22, the Lord told Moses to say to Pharaoh, Israel is my firstborn son. Let my son go that he may serve me. And if you refuse to let him go, behold, I will kill your firstborn son. And that is what happened. You know the story, Genesis, Exodus. Eventually Pharaoh let the people go. So when God rescued his people from slavery in the Exodus, he called his son, the people of Israel, out of Egypt. Okay, why does Matthew quote this now about Jesus going to Egypt? And the answer is this, that first Exodus in the second book of the Bible, that first Exodus, it set the pattern for a future Exodus. So Hosea looked forward to it later in chapter 11 of Hosea, 11 verse 10. The Lord will say there of his people, they shall come trembling like birds from Egypt, and I will return them to their homes. Now this Exodus in the future would be a greater one, it would be a spiritual one. So the prophets look forward to the day when God would rescue his people from slavery, not to Pharaoh, but to sin, to death, to the devil. But who would lead the people out in this ultimate rescue? Well, it would be the Messiah. It would be the Son of God. And so notice in our passage, did you spot it? It keeps referring to the child and his mother. Comes up verse 13, verse 14, verse 20, verse 21. Why does it not say the child and his mother and father? Because Joseph was there. But the point is that the child's father is ultimately not Joseph, who was his legal dad, but God himself. So Jesus is the Son of God the Father. Out of Egypt I called my son. And so God sends Jesus down to Egypt so he can then call him out from there. And when Jesus is called out of physical Egypt, it will symbolize that he is the one that God will use to lead his people out of spiritual Egypt. So like a greater Moses, he would rescue them from the dominion of darkness and take them to the promised land. Now, are you part of that rescued people? You can be, and we are, if we are disciples of Jesus. And if so, we should be full of thanks today that the Father has, Colossians 1 said, delivered us from the domain of darkness and transferred us to the kingdom of his beloved Son, in whom we have redemption, the forgiveness of sins. Jesus is leading his people out in this spiritual exodus from slavery to sin and death and the devil. So that is the ultimate exodus. So out of Egypt I called my son. And there was a guy called Nicholas Winton. I don't know if you know about him. He helped a total of 669 Jewish children to escape from the Nazi Holocaust. And he kept quiet about what he'd done. Just didn't tell people. And then 50 years later, the BBC found out about this and they invited him to an event. This was in 1988, where they told his story. And this guy, Nicholas Winton, was sitting in this theatre. He was in the front row of a theatre filled with people. And what he didn't know is that the other people sitting behind him and around him were the children that had been saved all those years ago by him, and he'd never met them since. And it builds up to this really moving moment when the host asks, he says, is there anyone in the audience tonight who owes their life to Nicholas Winton? And if so, could you please stand up? And he looks around and he sees this crowd of people rise to their feet. And the host says, on behalf of all of them, thank you very much indeed. Now, we won't do this right now, but if we did, if I asked you today, if I said, is there anyone in our audience, in our congregation, who owes their life to Jesus Christ? If so, please stand up now. Would you stand up? And if so, we should be full of thanks, even more so than those saved by Nicholas Winton, because we're saved from a far worse fate than even they were. But there's another lesson in this as well, and that is that the fact that Jesus became a refugee, that surely should shape our view of the marginalised, the asylum seeker, the refugee. That they matter. They're precious to God. And that we should love them and we should care for them. So I got a leaflet in the post this past week from LCM, London City Mission, who James here works for. And their ministry focuses on those on the margins of society. And the pamphlet is about, the title was, How Can We Welcome People Who Are Displaced? And it begins by saying, today, individuals and families are arriving in London seeking refuge from conflict, oppression, and poverty. There is precious healing and hope in Christ that people seeking refuge desperately need to know. Well, that is surely a right concern if we are disciples of the Christ who himself became a refugee, fleeing for his life. Now, if by contrast, if we think, well, God is only interested in the successful, the influential, these other people become invisible. But that is not how God operates, the God who sent his son to become one of the displaced. The location of the next episode is Bethlehem. So we turn from the displaced to the distressed. It is a horrific story, isn't it? This next bit. Verse 16, then Herod, when he saw that he'd been tricked by the wise men, became furious. And he sent and killed all the male children in Bethlehem and in all that region who were 2 years old or under, according to the time he had ascertained from the wise men. Herod was determined that he was going to destroy this rival king, the Christ, before he had a chance to grow up. Now, Jesus was probably only a few months old at this stage. But Herod, in his rage, his paranoia, he orders the slaughter of all the boys of 2 years or under, in Bethlehem. So completely unnecessary to go to that age, but he was furious. Now, Bethlehem wasn't a big place. Population was at most 1,000, maybe as small as 300 people in Bethlehem at the time. So probably we're talking not more than 20 boys of that age, two or under. But the horror is unimaginable, isn't it? There was a soldier who was speaking to the BBC last month about the breakdown he suffered after he witnessed untold horrors in Afghanistan. He recounts one patrol when he was with an interpreter who had become a really good friend, who stepped on an explosive device. And I'll spare you the details, but he says that as he looked into the crater, he says, what I saw that morning, a human being is not designed to see. And those parents in Bethlehem would have seen things a human being is not designed to see or to experience. The soldiers arriving at your home, storming in, grabbing your toddler out of your arms or your baby and killing them in front of you. At that time, though, it was a period full of atrocities. That kind of incident, it wouldn't even have made the headlines. But it's horrific, and Matthew sees theological significance in it. So verse 17. Then was fulfilled what was spoken by the prophet Jeremiah. A voice was heard in Ramah, weeping and loud lamentation. Rachel weeping for her children. She refused to be comforted because they are no more. It's a quotation from Jeremiah 31:15. Now that quotation is referring back to the exile. Back in 586 BC. We've come across this already in Matthew's Gospel. We had it in chapter 1. It was called the deportation to Babylon in 1 verse 11, 1 verse 12. So that's what it's referring to. So what happened is that God's Old Testament people in Judah, they were taken captive by the invading Babylonians, and they were assembled at this place here mentioned, Ramah, mentioned here in verse 18. They were assembled there. It was 8 kilometers north of Jerusalem. And then they were marched off into exile in Babylon. And the Rachel mentioned here is Jacob's wife. Now, I mean, she was long dead by this point, but she was seen as being the mother of the Jewish people. And here she's pictured as weeping for the people, weeping for her children, who were, it says, no more, in the sense that they had been deported. Now, why does Matthew quote this? How is this fulfilled in the massacre of the boys at Bethlehem? Well, it follows the same pattern. It follows the same pattern. That in both cases there is weeping and there is lamentation over the treatment of God's children. They were exiled back then. They were killed now. They were deported back then to Babylon. They were massacred now in Bethlehem. Now this pattern has carried on, hasn't it? And it's been repeated time and time and time again throughout the history of God's people, weeping over how they have been treated. There's the weeping of the persecuted church. There's the weeping of Christians whose families are hostile to their faith in Christ. There's the weeping of Jesus' disciples as we struggle against the world, the flesh, and the devil. There's the weeping also of believers enduring chronic conditions and bereavement and private struggles known only to them. So in the normal Christian life, there are plenty of tears. There's a lot of weeping. But there is also hope. So when you read this passage in Jeremiah, straight after it, straight after the weeping in Ramah passage, the Lord says this. This is Jeremiah, the next verse. It says, they shall come back from the land of the enemy. There is hope for your future. There is hope for your future. So the exiles would return. This is Jeremiah 31, 16, 17. The exiles will return. And then a few verses later, still in Jeremiah 31, it says this, behold, the days are coming. God says, when I will make a new covenant, I'll put my law within them and remember their sin no more. And so there's hope. And we've got exactly the same as happening in Matthew. There's weeping in Bethlehem, but there is hope. Why is there hope? Well, because Herod lost. So Herod's attempt to destroy the Christ, it failed. Jesus escaped before the soldiers arrived. And he would go on to do the new thing that God had promised all those years before through the prophet Jeremiah. So this Jesus would establish the new covenant in his blood. And he would bring forgiveness of sins. And through him the Spirit would be sent into our hearts. And one day he will lead his people out of exile in this world to our eternal home. And so although we weep, although there's plenty of tears in the Christian life, we also rejoice in present blessings and future hope. There's a documentary on Netflix, Apollo 13 Survival. You've seen that one? Oh, it's gripping stuff. It's about the moon mission which got into trouble. And it tells this nail-biting story of the struggle to get these astronauts safely home after their spacecraft developed problems halfway to the moon. They're running out of oxygen, they're running out of power, and what unfolded over the next 4 days was a rescue mission like no other. And the final drama is when this capsule enters the Earth's atmosphere, the final leg, and you have these 3.5 minutes where there's a radio blackout. And everyone back home on planet Earth is holding their breath. Did they make it? Or did they burn up on recovery? Spoiler warning. Put your fingers in your ears if you want to watch this. Finally, a voice of one of the astronauts, it crackles through on the comms. And on the ground, the people go berserk. They go wild, celebrating that these guys were finally, they were still alive, and they had finally made it home. And so on our journey, there is plenty of drama, and stress, and problems, and tears. But God will get his people home from exile. And when he does, there will be the mother of all celebrations. The final location in Matthew 2 here is Nazareth. So verses 19 to 20, an angel of the Lord appears again to Joseph in a dream. And he tells him, look, it's now safe to return to Israel. Herod's dead. So verse 21, Joseph obeys, brings the family back to Egypt. But then verse 22, when he arrives, he hears that Herod's son, Archelaus, had succeeded his father in Judea. And so Joseph was afraid to live there. Now, with good reason. Because Archelaus was a chip off the old block. He was as ruthless as his father. And so Joseph, being warned in a dream, verse 22, he withdrew to the district of Galilee. And he went and lived in a city called Nazareth. Now, there were good practical reasons for locating to Nazareth, as we've seen. And in fact, it used to be Mary and Joseph's hometown. We learn that from Luke's Gospel. But again, surprise, surprise, there is theological significance. So verse 23. And he went and lived in a city called Nazareth, that what was spoken by the prophets might be fulfilled. he shall be called a Nazarene. Now, this is different to the other two Old Testament quotations we've had so far today in this passage. This time you'll notice it's not what the prophet spoke, singular, but it's what the prophets spoke, plural. And it's not actually a biblical quotation. So you will not find any Old Testament verse that says that. So instead, this is it's a summary of what the Old Testament prophets foretold, namely that the Christ would be despised and rejected. Now, what's going on here? To be a Nazarene, to come from Nazareth, so to be a Nazarene, to come from Nazareth, it was to be despised. So Nazareth was an unimportant, obscure northern town. And so the southerners in Israel, they regarded people from Nazareth with their northern accents as backward and unsophisticated and, you know, low class. It was an insignificant nowhereville, you know, with a partly Gentile population. So if our kids went to visit, they'd say, "This place is dead." So it's how Londoners view Barrow-in-Furness, or Bolton, or Blackpool, or Burnley, or pretty much any place up north beginning with B. Now that is why, some of us are studying John's Gospel in growth groups, that's why in John 1:46, when Philip tells Nathanael they found the Messiah, Jesus of Nazareth, Nathanael pretty much spits, doesn't he? In disgust and disbelief. He says, "Can anything good come from Nazareth?" He's got, "Pah, got to be kidding." And in the Gospels, this title, Jesus of Nazareth, it's used as a taunt. It's used to mock him. And so you remember that Pilate put it on the inscription on the cross. Jesus of Nazareth, King of Kings, almost needs an exclamation mark after it. It's a joke. And in Acts 24, the Christians are dismissively called the sect of the Nazarenes. It's mocking them. And in John 7:52, the Pharisees declare, they say, "Look, no prophet arises from Galilee." Okay, it's unthinkable. So to be from Nazareth was to be despised. And that is what the Old Testament prophets said of the Christ, you see. They said that he would be despised, he would be rejected. I put a few examples in the footnotes there. Psalm 22:6, "I'm a worm and not a man, scorned by mankind and despised by the people." Isaiah 49, verse 7, "To one deeply despised, abhorred by the nation." Isaiah 53, our first reading, "He was despised and rejected by men." And so he was. What lessons are there for us today in this? Well, let me give you a couple. I think the first one is that rejection is normal. Rejection is normal. If we are disciples of this Christ who was the Nazarene, who was despised and rejected, why should we expect to be treated differently? If you want to join the cool gang, if you want to be honoured and respected and liked by everyone, best not become a disciple of Jesus, because he wasn't. And he warned, John 15, "If the world hates you, know that it has hated me before it hated you." But it's worth it, because the despised and rejected one in Isaiah 53, he bears the sins of the people. And when the Christ returns, he will return in power and glory, and his people will be honoured by him and by the Father. So it's worth it. I was reading this week about a Christian girl called Romana. She is 9 years old, and she lives in a village in northwest Bangladesh where almost everyone is Muslim. When her family decided to follow Jesus, the community turned against them. And when she gets to school, nobody says hello. Nobody sits near her in class. None of the other kids let her play with them at break time. And she says this. She says, "Look, I don't have any friends in school. because I'm a Christian and my parents are also Christian. And if I sit with the other kids, their parents tell them off and they say, she's a Christian. You can't mingle with them because Christians are bad. And when the children say something unkind, she says, I just keep smiling. But she says, I cry when I'm alone. And even the teachers say, in her school, the teachers say, don't mingle with the Christian. If you mingle with her, you might also become a Christian. And Romana sums up her daily experience as, I'm just alone. If you follow Jesus of Nazareth, you'll be treated as someone from Nazareth, as this 9-year-old girl is experiencing, despised, rejected. Jesus was called a Nazarene, and so are his disciples. And we need to be ready for this, and we need to prepare our kids for this. So that's the first lesson. A second lesson is that God delights to work through the rejected. Jesus spent most of his life in Nazareth. Have you ever wondered about, have you thought about that? He spent most of his life in Nazareth. That was his home from early childhood until he began his public ministry at the age of about 30. So almost all his life on earth, the Son of God, was spent in a small, obscure, insignificant, despised town up north. Why did God do that? Well, because God's ways are not our ways. So his value system is not that of the world. So God delights to work through what is small, ordinary, obscure, rejected. He's the God of small things, if we can put it that way. His power is made perfect in weakness. Now, if it had been up to us, we would have had Jesus grow up in Jerusalem, wouldn't we? Yeah, the capital. At the heart of the capital, at the centre of the action. We'd want him growing up, mixing with the powerful people, the influential people. That is not how God works. So on Wednesday evening, we had a Zoom call with one of our mission partners, for those who are here in Wednesday growth groups. And he's planted a church up in a rough town up north. Really, really tough area up north. Doesn't begin with B, but still pretty tough. Their Sunday service, he was telling us, 15, 20 people max meeting in some little community cafe. Why would you do that? Well, it's the Nazareth principle, isn't it? So we look at the map and we think, oh, well, this place is strategic for the gospel, that place, not up there. That's not worth it. But that's looking at things from a worldly perspective. Or, you know, if it had been up to us to choose the apostles, who would we have chosen to be the first 12? We'd have picked the brightest, the best, wouldn't we, from the top unis, leading companies. What does Jesus do? He chooses very ordinary working class blokes from despised Galilee. They're all northerners. All except for Judas were northerners. And you remember, it was Peter's northern accent that gave him away. When he denied Christ, when he claimed, I didn't know Jesus, said, well, actually, your accent gives you away there. And when Peter and John are called before the religious authorities in Acts 4, we read that when the authorities perceived that they were uneducated common men, they were astonished. It's the Nazareth principle. Now, contrast that with the strategy of the UN Christian camps. It's been in the news, of course, because of the Making Report, which we mentioned last week. If you missed the slot we did on that, in the What's On email, there's a link to what we were saying. But the thinking behind the Ewenminster Christian camps was that these boys from the top public schools in the country, they were the elite, and they would lead the church. They would turn things around. They would win the country for the gospel. These guys were the future. They were the key with all their privilege, their abilities, their wealth, their power, their education, their connections. It's just worldly thinking, isn't it? It's not how God works. And this Nazareth principle comes through into the early church as well, doesn't it? So, do you remember when Paul wrote to the church in Corinth in 1 Corinthians 1? He says, not many of you were wise according to worldly standards. He's been quite polite there. read between the lines. Not many of you were wise according to worldly standards. Not many were powerful. Not many were of noble birth. But God chose what is foolish in the world to shame the wise. He chose what is weak in the world to shame the strong. And he chose what is low and despised in the world. Some people think that church needs to be impressive. Yeah, church needs to be full of, you know, successful, attractive, educated, interesting people, and we need huge crowds of them. That's what will attract other people. And yeah, all the better if we can get a few celebrities in there as well. Wouldn't that be fantastic? It's not how God works. So location, location, displaced in Egypt, distressed in Bethlehem, despised in Nazareth. It's not impressive, but that is how God works. And so we can take heart because it means that God can work even through this little church. And he can work through little you. And he can work through little me. Someone has said, if you think you're too small to make a difference, you've never been in a room with a mosquito. But the principle works positively too. The tiny seed becomes a plant. Through the small, ordinary things of life, God is at work. Well, let's pause for a moment now to reflect on that, to pray, and then we're going to join together in prayer.